The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. And today's veteran is Ed Trust, who is a friend of mine. Ed, just give us a little rundown where you've been assigned.
Went through ROTC and got my commission back in 1976, and then came on active duty in 1977, and slated as a munitions officer. So I went through a technical training starting in February of 77, Bowery Air Force Base in Denver, and that was a pretty extensive course that we went through there.
And munitions is all the bombs and stuff like that.
Bombs and bullets, but mostly bombs. From there, my first active duty assignment was out at Mather Air Force Base, which is outside of Sacramento, and primarily we had B-52s there and KC-135s, and was part of the Strategic Air Command, or we referred to ourselves as being a SAC train killer at that time, and teach was our profession. But showed up there as a ripe new second lieutenant, and I guess one of the main thing is there was a slew of other lieutenants that were there. We all kind of, rotated in the different jobs. And I recall that my young success was latching off to a good NCO. And we had this one crusty chief that was in our supervision. And the standard answer out of his mouth was no. So periodically, I'd kind of go in and ask a question, and we would kind of lock horns, which was normal. And then at the end of the day or so, kind of get together and have a drink or two over at his house and kind of rehash the day.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of learn the error of my ways. And really, that was one of the things that I had picked up very early in my career was always latch on to a good NCO and
absolutely
turn it into a team.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Ed, your family, feel free to brag. Your family is really quite a history of veterans serving, and this being our Veterans Day edition, tell us a little bit about your extended family and what's going on there.
Well, I'll give you a little story. I have two boys and a girl, two sons and a daughter, and they're both in the Army. My oldest son is in the Army Guard in Georgia, National Guard, and he actually lives in Charlotte. And then I have another son that is down in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. But as far as on the family history, I'd kind of tell you a little story about how I kind of came across the names. My first one was Daniel, and during Desert Storm, I was stationed at in England at Fairford Air Force Base, and we were flying B-52 missions out of there, and I was responsible for the munitions that were being loaded on the aircraft. And so typically after my load crews go out there and load the bombs on the aircraft, then we would go out there and write little notes on the side of the aircraft, and what I wrote and have a bunch of photographs of is my wife's name's Kim and I'm Ed, and so I'd always write to Saddam with love from Ed and Kim and Kevin Logan. And everyone kind of takes a look at these photographs and saying, Kevin Logan, who's Kevin Logan? And it says, well, that was supposed to be my oldest son's name, but we decided that at the last minute to honor my father, that we would name him after my fifth great-grandfather, who was General Daniel Morgan in the Revolutionary War. So history goes back all the way to Revolutionary War. And one of his claims to fame was at the Battle of Cowpens, which is just south of you all in
South Carolina. Mm-hmm.
So we go up there every January 18th to celebrate the Battle of Cowpens. So kind of goes back all that way. And we've done some family history search, and I'm a member of the Sons of the American Revolution. And so Daniel Morgan had two daughters, and so that's where the Morgan name got dropped. But one of his daughters that they were descendants of married a James Heard, and so we have ties to Revolutionary War through him, who was a major in the Revolutionary War. Then it's kind of sketchy from there as far as going down the lines, but the next in line was my grandfather, who was a Cyril Trust, and he was in the Navy during World War One.
Mm-hmm.
And then next in line was my dad. My dad enlisted in the Army, and he was assigned to Fort McIntosh in Laredo, Texas. And there's where he met my mother. And he was actually in the light cavalry there. And that's prior to World War II, where they still used horses, and they would had light artillery pieces that they would strap on to the pack horses and move ahead. So some rather interesting stories that my father used to tell about that. And he was the only member of our family that has ever played polo. When we're being in the cavalry, that you learn to play polo. And
is that for real? Is that like training for knowing how to control the horse and so forth?
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
That was in the National Guard, and then basically myself, and now my two sons are in the Army as well. Of course, I was in the Air Force. Everyone asked me and said, "Well, since you're in the Air Force, said why didn't your children, why didn't your sons join the Air Force instead of the Army?" And the only thing I can kind of attribute it to is I bought way too many G.I. Joes for them and not enough airplane models.
That's a good one. And my son went in the Navy, of all things.
Yeah, I mean, so we both went wrong someplace there.
Yeah, yeah.
let me see. Back to assignment. Started the Major Air Force Base.
Tell me a little bit about the I've always noticed about the munitions people. There's a lot of camaraderie there. So maybe you can fill in some of those stories while you're telling me where you were stationed.
Well, you basically had the loaders, which are referred to as load toads, and their symbol is basically a frog or a toad, and kind of used in terms of slang there, where the other career fields would label them as. And then we have the ammo troops, which were actually the individuals that maintained the bombs. So you had the maintainers and you had the loaders as such, and then
potentially very dangerous.
It can be.
Yeah.
It can be, particularly if you have munitions that is electrically primed,
mm-hmm.
Such as in some of the guns as such.
Mm-hmm.
You always have to be careful when it comes to static electricity and make sure that your inspection tables are grounded and that you're basically grounded.
Mm-hmm.
But if you follow all the safety rules, it's really pretty easy as such.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, other places from Major Air Force Base there, I went back to Lowry as an instructor in munitions school that I had graduated from earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And spent 3 years there. And then from there, from Lowry, I went to USAFE, or United States Air Forces in Europe, as it's known as, on the inspection team, the Inspector General's team, where we traveled around to all different bases in Europe conducting inspections. And from there, I came back to Strategic Air Command and back to SAC, and was stationed as a maintenance supervisor in a munitions squadron at Castle Air Force Base there in Merced, California. Spent 3 years there, and then went to Saudi Arabia as a munitions advisor to the Saudi Air Force. It's part of the Foreign Military Sales Program, that the United States military has with foreign governments. And that's where I met my wife. And everyone says, you married a foreigner? And says, yeah, kind of. She's from Tennessee. And with that, I usually get slugged in the arm.
I forgot about that, Ed. So Kim was over there. What was she doing over there?
She was actually a civilian and working as a dental hygienist in the Royal
Hospital. That's right. That's right. I remember that now.
Her first military function that she'd ever been to was actually we had a reception for General Schwarzkopf, who was our general at that time. And, of course, later on, when Desert Storm hit, he had a much bigger role of being in charge of the military for Desert Storm. I met Kim over there, and then I came back. She still had another year contract on her contract there with the hospital, but came back and took over as a munitions squadron commander at Acre Air Force Base, which is Blytheville, Arkansas. It's about 55 miles or so north of Memphis on the Arkansas side, and was there and had Daniel was born there, and got married there with Kim, and it took a long time discussion in terms of marrying me as such. I mean, we had already decided, but she finally came back from her assignment, and her first exposure to the Air Force and went out of that Acre is we had what we called a commander's New Year's Eve reception, which is a very formal reception. Everyone is in their mess dress uniforms, and you go over to the officers' club, and you have this big, long receiving line where you have the honor of walking down the receiving line and taking everyone's hand, and everyone hated it because they'd rather go out and attend New Year's Eve parties rather than being tied up in the Oak Club as such. We had in the process of talking, we're kind of in line for our particular segment, and there's a very striking lady in the crowd who's and she just seemed to be very miserable, like all of us were. The next day is when Kim decided and said, I can't do this military life. And it's just everyone seems so miserable. And said, well, please don't base it upon just that one function. No one wanted to be there.
Right.
And so after she drove back to Tennessee, and about a 5-hour trip back home, then she called me up and says, yes, okay. I thought about it. Let's go ahead and get married. And,
outstanding.
It was kind of quick after that, from New Year's Eve in February, and everyone says, "Oh, you must have gotten married at for Valentine's Day." And says, "No, it was actually on the 18th of February." And says, "Well, why did you pick out that day?" And says, "Well, it was a 3-day weekend for the military, and that way friends that were coming in did not have to take leave to show up, and so it kind of did it for them." But the wedding almost didn't happen as far as the reception or so, because the Officers' Wives Club was having an art auction that particular day at the Oak Club, and I had to get permission from them to kind of move into a different room so I could have the main ballroom as a reception.
I see. How'd that work out?
Well, it worked out. I mean, over 30 years married, so...
Well, I knew the marriage worked out. I was wondering if you had any trouble with the ballroom.
Right. And from there, from that assignment, Acre Air Force Base was closing. And so had a choice of assignments, either to go to Hawaii or go to Grand Forks, North Dakota, where my boss had basically wanted me to come up there and take over one of the squadrons. And I opted for Grand Forks, North Dakota, as opposed to going to Honolulu.
Oh.
The adage is, and for anyone listening out there, you go for what the best assignment is, and the location isn't necessarily the best assignment, but
right.
Going to North Dakota was a lot better for my career than going to Hawaii. Actually, my second son said, "You mean I could have been born in Hawaii?" And I said, "Well, you know, you could have not been born at all."
Was that Logan?
So we spent 3 years at Grand Forks Air Force Base. Actually, we count them in terms of winters.
And
everyone lives for the summer. And as soon as it hits 32 degrees, it's really funny because you'll see people going outside of their houses in T-shirts and shorts. So once you've kind of been locked up all winter long and everything, it's summer is relevant.
Oh, my gosh. Mm. So did you ever get to Hawaii?
I took a hop over there back when I was a lieutenant. And other than that, never been to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. So where'd you go after North Dakota?
North Dakota, the last assignment was to Hill Air Force, where I had the opportunity of meeting Frank Irvin there.
That's right.
We're kind of neighbors, pretty much.
We were.
Apart from each other.
And we were lucky to get on that side of the base, I thought.
Oh, well, very, very. So it was pretty neat. We lived in a duplex. It was a two-story duplex across the street from the headquarters building.
Mm-hmm.
And then you all lived in a fourplex, just kind of cut a corner from that.
Yeah. We were surrounded by several acres of very green grass, but that only a little bit of it was ours to take care of. The base had to take care of the rest of the grass, and of course they did a very good job because it was right out the general's window. You know?
Oh, definitely.
We got a good deal there. We had some good parties, some good memories.
Right. When our kids would play together, I know that the boys learned to ride their bicycles over there,
yeah.
And they're always right in front of the general's house over there, and it's like, okay, guys, be on your best behavior when you're out, will you?
Yeah.
Typically, they would ride their bikes in the evenings and weekends around the headquarters building, which is right across from us.
It was really idyllic for a place to be with the young children. As opposed to a big base like Hill, had a huge family housing area on the other side of the base.
Right.
And we were
right.
Kind of fortunate to be on the neighbors of the general. Of course, that's a double-edged sword, but we had a great commander there, and it was an honor to work for. Tell some munition stories. Something funny or something sad or something dangerous, whatever. I'm sure you...
One funny story is that, you know, being in munitions, you always like to blow up stuff. And it seems like the only people that get to blow up stuff are the explosive ordnance disposal folks, the EOD folks. And one base that we would go to inspect had an EOD unit over there. And so we were on an inspection and... got there a few days early because of the flight structures, and we had our general that was with us, and the EOD folks decided, so, well, you know, we can go out and show you some explosives and let you detonate some, and so we all went out there and had fun blowing up these concrete walls and stuff that they had set up for testing and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the general was really impressed, and he told the story that when he was responsible for an acquisition program as such, and that they were going to put on a demonstration beforehand on some of the munitions, and they had a tank that was going to be a target, and the EOD folks had salted, as they referred to as kind of witching up the explosives a little bit, and so aircraft rolls in, fires its guns, and holy heck, this this tank totally glows blows up a little bit more than what they wanted for the demonstration. Because they kind of overdid it as far as salt in the tank so it would go off. It's very similar to where you see these vintage air shows where the commemorative Air Force will come out and stage a Torah type exhibit, vintage aircraft flying. Well, this was kind of, his version of the Torah. Like, boy, did that really go well.
Now, when I think of, before I met you, when I think about bombs, I would think about model airplanes that I used to have as a kid, and the bomb, you just glue it up under the wing. Tell us how, in reality, what's involved in loading bombs up, besides the danger, and then the, how do you get it up there, and how does it come off?
To load them up, first of all, you have to have a bomb rack, bomb racks that we have are normally, they have hooks built into them, two sets of hooks, one that is 14 inches apart and then another one that is 30 inches apart. And depending on how big or heavy the munitions item is, depending on how it hooks up there. So if you think of having an aircraft and you have a pylon out on the aircraft, you have a bomb rack attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're loading something like a 2,000-pound bomb, you just merely don't go out there and load it. Perhaps some of the Navy folks, think that you can do it that way. And the Navy kind of does things differently.
But, zing.
Say a 500 or 2,000-pound bomb, and you have what is called a bomb lift truck, or we commonly refer to them as jammers, because that's kind of what you're doing is you're jamming the bomb up underneath the aircraft and suspending it from the from these hooks,
mm-hmm.
on the bomb rack. And depending on whether it's a dumb bomb, as they're referred to, or is a smart bomb, there's all sorts of checkouts that have to go on the aircraft to make sure that all systems are working and that you're not going to have any inadvertent releases of the aircraft of the munitions from the aircraft. So it isn't just a matter of stuffing a bomb up there in a bomb rack, but all the aircraft checkouts for ensuring that functionality and safety are adhered to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in terms of loading it. That's what it entails. And if it's a larger munitions item, say that would fit on a B-52, now the B-52s and have advanced and also the B-1s for that matter to such a level that they have different configurations of rotary launchers where you can go out and you would load a launcher that would rotate around, say, 8 positions and load the individual bombs up on there. And, they have carry a lot of the smart munitions as such. And mm-hmm. so there's a certain amount of aircraft to weapon interface that is configuring the weapon for its specific mission. So there's quite a bit of testing that has to go out there in advance of a mission and such.
Mm-hmm.
And on this weapons storage area side, where the ammo troops reside, they're having to take the smart bombs and the guidance and control sections of them and periodically checking them out and ensure that they're still serviceable, and that's done on a periodic basis.
Yeah. Any particular stories that you can think of to add to it? Anything in your career?
Anything in my career. I guess one kind of funny is when we wound up at this one particular base that I mentioned before, where my wife was with me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I told her that I worked munitions, she thought I dealt with bombs and bullets. My maintenance supervisor's wife had called talked to her one day and says, "Well, did Ed get that call last night for about umpty 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 up?" sitting out there on the flight line. And she says, no, okay. She says, why? And says, well, it dealt with this and that, and won't go into any details on that. But she says, Ed doesn't deal with that. He deals with little bullets. And so when I came home, it was like, almost like the wife sitting there waiting with a frying pan. What do you do? She said, well, dadgummit, you know, she said, one of the spouses has been talking again. So, load her up in the car and drive around to the aircraft alert and kind of point it out on the aircraft, and those things that were on the aircraft were the things that I dealt with. So kind of lightened there.
Yeah, the wives have to learn a lot when they marry someone in the military.
A commander had to go up to the Offutt Air Force Base, which is SAC headquarters at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a week-long orientation course on how to be a commander from the standpoint of all the documentation, mm-hmm. and the different programs that you have to administer as a commander. Everything from a weight management program of your troops, you know, on down the line. And at the same time, the wives that were invited to it go along in that one specific TDY and kind of learn the ins and outs about being a commander's wife and mm-hmm. things you say and things that you don't say. And one of the funny things there was that I guess the first day that they had their session, one of the females that was in charge of this program says, okay, well, we want all the wives, you know, to kind of stand up and, you know, my husband's a colonel, okay, a lieutenant colonel, okay, I'm over here, oh, well, you're a major, oh, you're over there and stuff. And after they got all lined up and what they thought was, you know, rank responsibilities and stuff, the lady ended up saying, it says, you all are wrong. It said, your husband or your spouse is the one with the rank, not you. So, you know, they're kind of sitting straight, so, you know, the spouses don't go out there and carry their spouse's rank, because yeah. they don't have any rank.
Yeah. Well, also, same goes to certain people who have a job where they're working closely with the commanding officer. You don't dare try to act like you wear the commanding officer's rank, or the rest of the staff will be all over you. You won't survive.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Gosh, Ed, this has been great for you to share some of your memories. Our audience will certainly appreciate it.
Well, the only thing I'd like to say is that we're coming up on the anniversary of the 11th month, the 11th day at the 11th hour. You know, over the years, there's been a lot of sacrifice, and anyone that is in the military, regardless of what it is that you've done, and are all important in my mind. You know, we are one force together, even though we make fun about our different sister services out there.
Sure.
We all do it together, and we're always willing to do so. And so my hat's off is to anyone that has served, whether it's 20-plus years or 4 years.
Thanks, Ed, for this edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast. Address any comments or questions to us at 919-832-5138. I'm Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service.